Court will now hear argument in IBP Inc. versus Alvarez and Tum versus Barber Foods Inc. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. There are two issues in this case. One concerns walking time, and the other concerns waiting time. And unless the court has a different order, I'd propose to start with the walking time. Section 4A1's language, which comes from the Portal to Portal Act, which was enacted in 1947, by its plain terms, clearly covers the walking that's involved in these two cases. The statute, which is reproduced at the appendix to the petition at 88A, says that there is no mandatory compensation for, quote, walking to and from the actual place of performance of the principal activity or activities which such employee is employed to perform. It's difficult for me to imagine language that could more directly cover what we're dealing with in this particular case, because the plaintiffs here are unquestioned for IBP are employed to slaughter and to process beef. The employees at Barber Foods are employed to process chicken. And thus the actual place where they perform those services are obviously on the lines where the processing takes place.
I would have thought that, but we've held otherwise.
Well, I don't know that I don't know of any case where this court has held otherwise.
Well, we've held that the principal activity consists of donning and doffing the clothes required, haven't we?
Well, this court said that donning and doffing was a principal activity in contradistinction to a preliminary or post-liminary activity for purposes of Section 4A2. But the court specifically said in Steiner that that holding does not apply to matters that are specifically excluded under Section 4A1, which deals with walking time, Justice Scalia.
So you think Steiner is irrelevant?
No, I don't think it's irrelevant to the workplace. I think it is irrelevant to the proper disposition of this case, yes.
Well, it is if we don't accept the continuous workday rule. If we do accept the continuous workday rule, why isn't it, in effect, the premise from which the conclusion for the other side falls?
Well, we don't have any quarrel with the continuous workday rule. The question is, when does the workday begin? And our assessment of the workday, as defined in Section 4A1, which controls specifically the walking time in this particular case, begins when you arrive at the actual place where you're going to perform the services.
No, but your argument assumes that there is only one actual place. And their argument, which is consistent with the text of the statute, is that there may be more than one principal activity and hence more than one place. And if the place of donning and doffing is such a place, then wouldn't it be at least administratively odd to apply the continuous workday rule immediately to exclude some walking time that follows that?
No, I don't think so. I think it is perfectly sensible and a clear bright line rule, Justice Souter, to say that when you arrive at the actual place where you perform not just any activities and not just the activities that are integral and indispensable to your working activities, but to the principal activities for which you're hired. And admittedly, there can be more than one of those. But that doesn't, you know, donning and doffing is not a principal activity of anyone.
So you're saying so-called integral activities are not principal activities.
Right. They don't have to be principal activities. They're better understood. Not
Mr. Phillips, the Steiner opinion explicitly agreed with the lower court in the case, which said that the term principal activity or activities embraces all activities that are integral and indispensable.
Right.
And if you think that putting on the clothes fall within that, then that covers walking, too, after that.
The problem with that analysis is that the court was only analyzing Section 4A2 for these purposes. And what it was saying is we are prepared to accept that there are certain activities that are either preliminary or post-preliminary, and then there are others that are primary activities. And if you are integral and indispensable to a primary activity, it is a compensable event. Recognizing that Steiner is probably the most extraordinarily extreme facts that you could imagine, because we're talking about clothing that had to be changed in order to protect the public health
Phillips,
and safety.
You're asking us to interpret the same words, principal activity or activities, differently in sub 2 that was at issue in Steiner, and in sub 1, and then the clause that follows both of those. The same phrase is used. So if principal activity includes donning or doffing under sub 2, why wouldn't the same follow for sub 1 and the following.
Because you have to read the language principal activity or activities in A1 within the context of what Congress was trying to achieve by the Portal to Portal Act, which was to absolutely and categorically exclude walking time from being part of mandatorily compensated activities of a particular employee.
But it is included if it's once the workday begins, if there's a rotation, you walk from one station to the other, that walking time, I think it's conceded, would be included.
Right. But that,
so if you date, if the principal activity is donning and doffing, then the walking time thereafter would also be included.
But, Justice Ginsburg, if you step back and think about this language in the context of the words that are written here, it says walking to and from the actual place of performance of the principal activity. No one would think
or
that
activities.
That, or activities. But again, Justice Souter, all that suggests is that there are times when somebody who's working in a clothing operation may actually, you know, may spend time distributing the cloth or may spend time actually sewing the cloth. Those are two separate activities, or they're different activities. But it doesn't mean, and it certainly doesn't convert anything that can be described as integral and indispensable into a primary activity which such employee is employed to perform. No employee in these cases was employed to perform the act of putting on clothes or the act of picking up equipment.
What do you think about the possibility it depends on the clothes and depends on the equipment, so that in Steiner and here, it's a lot of protective gear. It's really quite part of the job and special and unusual. In Mount Clemens, it's a kind of uniform. It's just washing your hands up, putting on an apron. So where it's minor putting on clothes, as someone might in his house, doesn't come in substantial, doesn't come in integral and indispensable. But where it's quite a big deal, it does. And who decides? The agency.
Well, there are two parts about that that are worth focusing on. One is I don't think you can lump the two cases together, because the clothing or the equipment that has to be put on with respect to the Barber Foods company is quite minimal, and indeed was deemed to be de minimis. So I'm not sure you can lump the two cases together in that way. But also, in terms of where the Secretary comes out on this, let's not forget 79.7G footnote 49, which is candidly the clearest statement from the Secretary with respect to what do you do when you have donning and doffing that is followed by walking time. And what is the regulation specifically say? And that's on, I think, 92 and 93 of the appendix to our petition. It specifically says that walking time is not excluded, not necessarily
excluded. It's really noncommittal on the point.
Well, except that under their theory of this case, it is always excluded, always. So that whatever else you can say about the meaning of that particular language, the interpretation the Secretary offers to you today flatly rejects
but in that language. That footnote, that's where I actually got the idea. It says we reserve in certain situations. To me, that meant sometimes it can be a major big deal to don clothing, protective gear. Sometimes it isn't, an apron. And whose job is it? Now I'm repeating myself.
Right.
The Secretary's.
No, but and if we were talking about that in the context of other kinds of activities, if you're back in the A2 world of looking at whether something's preliminary or post-preliminary, I have less of a problem with dealing with that. The problem is, here we're talking about A1 activities, the core of what Congress enacted the Portal to Portal Act to protect employers for. The Portal to Portal Act is not a statute that remotely provides protections for the employees. This is a statute that was designed to protect employers from billions of dollars of liability. And so when you're talking about under what circumstances can you ignore the flat prohibition on requiring walking time to be regarded as a mandatory subject of compensation, then it seems to me the distinction you're proposing doesn't work. And it's also, Justice Breyer, again, flatly inconsistent. That's not their theory of the case. Their theory of the case is, if we can describe it as in any way integral and indispensable to some other activity, that makes it a primary activity. That starts the workday, and everything after that then becomes compensable.
Mr. Phillips, can I call your attention to the text of Section 254A? It's in the red brief in the Alvarez case at App 1. What it says is that you don't have to pay overtime compensation or minimum wages for an account of any of the following activities. One, walking, riding, blah, blah, blah. This is one.
Yes.
For the place of performance of the principal activity or activities which such employee is employed to perform.
Now, you've skipped over an actual place there.
Right, okay.
But which I think is an important word.
Two, activities which are preliminary to or post-liminary to said principal activity or activities. You're trying to sever one and two when the text itself joins them. The activities referred to in two are said principal activity or activities. The said refers to the ones that are in one.
Right.
How can we possibly sever one and two and say that for purposes of one, it means one thing. For purposes of two, it means something else.
Because when the court was interpreting A2 in Steiner, it wasn't interpreting A2 to determine whether something was a preliminary or post-liminary activity in connection with said primary activities. What it was saying is these are not preliminary and post-liminary activities, that they are excluded from that. And so the court's really coming up with what is a third category of cases, which deals with integral and indispensable activities to a primary activity. They didn't have to analyze it as a primary activity. All they had to say was it's not that the preliminary and post-liminary activities are not simply temporal, that there's a substantive component to it. And that is essentially the holding of the court in Steiner. It says there's a substantive component, and therefore we're not going to just simply look in time-wise whether it comes before or after principal activities. We're going to decide that there are some situations that are so important that they need to be compensated under A2 because they don't fall within preliminary or post-liminary language.
But, Mr. Phillips, it says either something is before preliminary or after post-liminary. And if it's neither of those, then it seems to me it's not before the principal activity and it's not after the principal activity. So what else is it other than the principal?
It's work that's mandatorily compensable under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Remember, the Fair Labor Standards Act, under this Court's interpretations from Mount Clemens Pottery and the cases that preceded it, had a very sweeping definition of what is work within the meaning of what is compensable as minimum wages and as overtime. And that's in place. And now Congress has stepped in and said, well, wait a second, when that got interpreted that broadly, we're talking about $6 billion in liabilities. So it's very important, given that we're talking about fairly minimal activities that are involved here, triggering potentially massive liabilities. And so what we've done is we've excluded from those massive liabilities the walking, riding, and traveling time, because that's the basis on which you end up with big numbers.
So your approach introduces really a third concept. You have the principal activities, and you have either preliminary or post-liminary, and now you've got a third concept, integral. But the statute, that's nowhere in the statute.
Right. Well, that's this Court's decision, and Steiner was the one that reached out to decide that integral and indispensable was a category of activities that were going to be compensable, even though on the face of them they may have appeared
well,
to be.
Well, unless they were saying those activities were, in fact, principal activities. If it's integral, if it's embraced by the principal activity, it is a principal activity, and that at least is more consistent with the statute in keeping it in two categories rather than inventing a third.
Well, I don't think that creates any particular problem, but what you end up doing, Mr. Chief Justice, under those circumstances is you completely eliminate the protection that Congress meant to provide here for walking, riding, and traveling time, which is the vital consideration of.
Well, how does your analysis apply? Let's say these employees had to change their equipment several times during the course of the day.
You mean after they've arrived at the actual place of their
performance? The equipment is only good for, an hour, 2 hours, then they have to get new. They have to walk back to the place.
Right.
They have to doff the other equipment, don new equipment, and walk back. Wouldn't your analysis say that walking time is excluded?
No.
Why not?
We don't have any quarrel with the argument that once you, for the first time, arrive at your actual place of performing the principal activity for which you were hired, which is cutting beef or whatever it happens to be in your hypothetical, once you arrive there, that does begin the workday. That's the definition of what starts the workday, which is why, to our mind, this is a much clearer and brighter line rule. We can tell you precisely when you start the workday. It's when you get to the place where you got hired to work and start to do that work.
Do you have compensated activities that do not begin the workday?
Yes, you do have compensated. And that's true for lots of different situations, Justice Kennedy. You can have a situation where you go home and you get called back in on an emergency, and nobody disputes that that's clearly compensable time, and nobody has ever seriously argued that you ought to extend the workday.
What happens with a microchip or a laboratory with highly contagious viruses where there has to be 2 hours of scrubbing, then there's a walk? What do you do with that?
If the
2 hours of scrubbing
it's very possible that the scrubbing will be regarded as an integral and indispensable part of the employment, and therefore is compensable.
But then there's a walk. What about the walk?
The walk is not compensable because Congress didn't want you to have walking until you got to the actual place where you would perform the services. And nobody's principal activity as an employee is to go take a shower or to go and pick up certain types of clothing. That's not understanding of principal activity.
Mr. Phillips, the problem I continue to have is that I thought Steiner embraced explicitly the notion that principal activity embraces all activities that are integral and indispensable. You take issue with that, but do you want us to overrule Steiner?
No.
Or make some changes in it? I just don't understand.
I want you to limit Steiner to the very unusual facts that arose in that particular context. We don't have any quarrel with the indispensable and integral test as a reason for compensating certain activities.
What was so unusual about the facts in Steiner? They're pretty common.
Well, no, the notion that if you didn't shower and change, you would expose not only yourself but your family and everybody else to the risks of lead poisoning is a pretty extraordinary.
No, but the routine where you have to don, safety equipment and you have to shower when you're done, whether it's being the meat packing or the stuff in Steiner, that's a pretty common occurrence.
Right. Well, I would argue that you could make a claim that none of that donning and doffing ought to be compensable, and candidly, we made that argument, but unfortunately, the court didn't grant the petition on that particular question. So we have to take it as a given. But for exactly the reason you identify, Mr. Chief Justice, that does create a problem. I mean, part of this problem is a bit contrived. I don't think that the ordinary donning and doffing ought to trigger the beginning of the workday. But assuming that I still don't think that even if you accept that that is compensable conduct within the meaning of Steiner, that's what it's talking about. But Steiner, Justice O'Connor, doesn't say anything about the fact that there was going to have to be walking or traveling or the workday. The court in Steiner clearly had in mind the workplace where you're producing batteries. There's a lot of language in that opinion. It says this is where you really do the work. That's your battery. And here's where you're going to get engaged in activities that we think you need to be compensated. But the court never remotely suggested that you were entitled to the walking time between those two. And if you go back to 790.7G, that language specifically told every employer that simply because you have to pay for certain kinds of activities at the outset, because they're integral and indispensable as decided by a court, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to pay for all the walking time. And so you've got to come up with a theory that supports that.
You would say that's so for all activities that are integral and indispensable. What about sharpening tools?
Well, sharpening tools is the easiest one because you do that right on the workplace. I mean, that's exactly what Congress had in mind in its legislative history.
That's not the hypothetical. Let's suppose you sharpen the tools outside by your locker, and then you go for a 10-minute walk to get to the place, and you carry the sharpened tool.
Well, again, if the court decides the sharpening of the tools, even though it's done not at the same time, which is what Congress had in mind when it identified that hypothetical, but even if you assume that that's integral and indispensable, it still isn't what triggers the time for starting the actual employment.
No, but isn't the answer that you just gave, and an answer which you have in fact consistently repeated, inconsistent with Steiner? Steiner didn't say there is a separate category of integral activities. Steiner said that activities which are integral are part of the principal activity. And isn't your argument premised on denying that identity?
No, I can accept that identity for purposes of distinguishing between what's preliminary and post-preliminary activity. What I cannot do is embrace that for purposes of deciding when walking time, traveling time ought to be included. Congress was as plain as it could humanly be in saying that we're not going to allow walking and traveling time to be included in an unexpected fashion. And that is precisely, as the Chamber of Commerce brief says, that is precisely what we're talking about here. And candidly, as Judge Boudin said in his concurring opinion, the circumstances arising in this context bear a very eerie resemblance to the situation that gave rise to the Portal to Portal Act in the first place. And so, and I think it's important to put this into context. You know, the language of this statute, as I read it, clearly is in our favor. The purpose of this statute is clearly in our favor. And then the question is, did this Court, in a decision that dealt solely with 4A2, mean to vastly change the scope of 4A1 in a way that would dramatically expose employers to liability?
Why is it so dramatic if we recognize that nothing begins until the donning and doffing, that is, the travel to wherever you don and doff? Well, none of that is included, even from the plant gate to the place where you don and dock.
But well, in part because plants are not — have never been designed. Remember, we've got 79.6. The Secretary of Labor told employers for 50 years, you can set up your plant without fearing that you're going to suddenly be hit with walking time after somebody engages in donning and doffing, even if it turns out to be integral and indispensable. For 50 years, they followed that advice. They've set up all of their plants with that expectation, and now this Court, if it follows the Ninth Circuit's lead, will suddenly say, okay, what you need to go out and find is all of the integral and indispensable activities, not just donning and doffing, any integral and indispensable activity that you can get a court to buy into, that will start this ever-expanding workday such that any walking that goes on after that and before you get done with all of these ever-expanding post-doffing activities, then you have so you have this broad, and that's why you're going to have substantially greater and totally unexpected liabilities.
Where's that advice contained that you say was given to
790.7G, footnote 49. And it says as plain as day.
Not necessarily.
Right, but their theory means always, always.
And you say that they operated on the assumption that it meant never.
No, I'm prepared.
It seems to me they were on notice that although it did not necessarily, it might.
But
you're exaggerating the effect of that statement.
But Justice Scalia,
right? They don't say. I mean, they exclude, for example, the canine cases where you have to walk and feed the dog in the morning before you show up at work. So
well,
they're not saying
Secretary does. I don't know that the plaintiffs necessarily do. Certainly, the plaintiffs in those cases didn't. They took the position that the workday started as soon as you engaged in protecting the canines. Just as in the insurance industry, the insurance adjusters are all taking the position that as soon as they have to get on the computer, that's an integral and indispensable part of their day, and everything after that, including traveling and movement, are all part and parcel of what gets added in there. What I'm suggesting to you is that once you go down this path and you say, okay, we're going to define the workday by reference to whatever somebody determines is integral and indispensable, you are going to have an expandable workday. And that if you are really looking for a fairly clear rule, you stick with what the language of the statute says, which is the actual place of the performance of the activity for which you were hired. Once you've got that in place, that's not to say that's the full length of when you get compensated. You can be compensated for activities outside of that workday. Happens every day when you have to come in for an emergency or if you have to come in.
My problem with your argument is Steiner.
I understand the problem with Steiner, Justice Kennedy, but I think it is inappropriate to read Steiner, which says point blank, our holding does not deal with conduct that is specifically excluded by 4A1. And ignore that. That statement of the holding of the court seems to me to say all we're telling you the answer to is 4A2.
The only thing specifically included in A1 is walking, riding, or traveling to and from the actual place of performance of the principal activity or activities. And once you assume that principal activity or activities includes everything that's integral and essential to principal activities, A1 doesn't cover it.
No, you can get to the logic of that. The question is it appropriate to apply the integral and indispensable test, which is an atextual standard, in a way that essentially guts 4A1 and the fundamentally important values that it was designed to serve? And what I'm suggesting to you is that's a mistake. And we know that because the regs protected us against this precise event. It is exactly what the Portal to Portal Act was designed to accomplish, and it's the better interpretation of this particular statute.
Mr. Phillips, may I just ask you a preliminary question about the IBM case, IBP case. As I understand it, whatever we do here is irrelevant to what the bottom line is going to be in that case, because the determination is going to be made wholly under state law. The court below said that's what it was going to do, and the employees are not objecting. So it seems that that case, as distinguished from Tom, is really not anything that this court should decide, because it would be academic.
Well, they don't argue that it's moot. It's not purely academic. There are collateral consequences to deciding what the federal law issue is in this particular context. We briefed this issue at the cert stage at some length, and the court granted cert. So I'm assuming that in some respects you've sort of passed by that particular problem. There are collateral consequences. And the other side, again, doesn't say it's that it has mooted this case. It simply says that there's a serious issue on remand as to precisely how it will all play out.
Could you give us a collateral consequence? I mean, what
yeah, because it res judicata collateral estoppel effects from a ruling that we have violated federal law, both that it might be available to the Secretary of Labor and otherwise. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve
Thank
the balance
you, Mr.
of my time.
Mr. Goldstein.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. As the previous questioning suggests, the outcome of this case follows directly from Steiner. The Portal Act, by its terms, applies only to activities that occur before the commencement of or the commencement of or after the conclusion of the employee's principal activities. Steiner holds that donning and doffing, such as in this case, is part of, that's a quote, the employee's principal activities, and it therefore follows that the Portal Act applies only to activities either prior to or after that donning and doffing.
Why isn't walking from the gate of the factory to the place where you're on the assembly line, why isn't that integral and essential to the performing of the activities?
Because, and this is the language that Mr. Phillips is referring to in Steiner, 4A1 itself makes clear that a walk will not be the first principal activity, including on the theory that it's integral and indispensable. The first principal activity has to be something other than a walk, and that's what happens in this case. As in Steiner, there is donning at the beginning of the day. That's part of the principal activities.
But once you accept the theory that the principal activity includes those things that are integral, you can say walking from the gate of the plant to the assembly line is part of the principal activity. Now, walking to the gate may not be part of the principal activity. But why?
Two reasons, Justice Scalia. The first is the one that I gave, and that is the Steiner Court concluded that, and that was the end of the sentence where it said, except as excluded by 4A1, that Congress made clear in 4A1 that the initial walk wouldn't be the first principal activity. Second, the walk won't be integral and indispensable. The test for whether or not something is integral and indispensable is whether it's work that's required and closely related to the productive activities, and simply walking to the donning station is not. That's in contradistinction to putting on the clothes that are required here, required as a matter of law, in order to do your job. That's the line that the statute draws.
Well, what about the dog grooming cases?
The dog cases, Justice Kennedy, and let me make sure I have your hypothetical, and that is the police officer at home grooms the dog, then comes into the office. That is part of their principal activities. The subsequent commute is not compensable on the ground that it is a break and a commute. That's covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Portal Act is concerned with something else, that is before the beginning and after the end of your day. The dog cases are, of course, also entirely different from this one. You have arrived at the place of the performance of your principal activity. Steiner said that occurred, quote unquote, on or off the production floor. And so you're at the plant and your workday has started. Justice Scalia, you made the point, and I simply want to reinforce it, that the reference to principal activities in 4A2 is the same as the reference to principal activities in 4A1. but it's also the reference to principal activities in the concluding clause of Section 4. If I could just take the court to that, the statute is obviously reproduced in a variety of places, but it's also at page 3 of our brief. And so after 4A1 and 4A2, there's this concluding clause, and the text frames the workday. And it says that the Portal Act, 4A1 and 2, will apply to activities which occur, I'm quoting now, which occur either prior to the time on any particular workday at which such employee commences, or subsequent to the time on any particular workday at which he ceases such principal activity or activities. And it simply follows, as a matter of the plain text, that when Steiner held that those activities, such principal activities, include the donning and the doffing, that everything that happens between those two events is not encompassed by the Portal Act.
Your answer to Justice Kennedy said that the dog cases were distinguishable because there was a break in the principal activity. So if we were to rule in your favor, all the employer has to do is make sure that the donning and doffing station is far enough away from the production line so that there'll be a sufficient break between the two activities.
Well, both the donning and the doffing and the walking in between and the wait for the equipment, which is the bulk of the time in all of these cases, would be compensable. The Department of Labor has regulations.
It would be. That's my question.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chief Justice. The donning and doffing in the Alvarez case, by and large, happens in one place, in a locker room. In the Tum case, by contrast, the employees show up at a cage, they wait for things, they walk, they pick up something else, they wait, they pick up something else. And so there's a body of time that I refer to as the donning and doffing process. All of that would clearly be compensable, even in your hypothetical. Your hypothetical would address the final piece of time, and that is you get your last piece of clothing on and you have to go to the floor. And the employer could say, take a 15-minute break in there. I suppose that's hypothetically possible. I think the reason it doesn't happen in these cases and in the other cases I've studied is that the employer has an incentive when they're forced to compensate to do things efficiently. What happens is the employer will say, all right, your shift is going to start at 6:30 in the morning. Therefore, you can clock in and start donning at 6:23. That's a 7-minute window, and that forces the employees to do everything efficiently. They don't insert artificial breaks.
Yeah, but why? If you're talking about efficiency, it may well be that the employees, instead of imposing upon the employer the costs of moving the donning and doffing location closer to the place where the real work is being done, they might prefer instead to get a slight salary increase per hour. But and that is possible under the petitioner's scheme because it is left to private negotiation, whereas what you say is that they must pay for that. They must pay for that walk from the donning and doffing. They cannot negotiate out of it because if it's in the Fair Labor Standards Act, it is mandatory. So don't talk to us about efficiency. It seems to me that the efficiency arguments are on the other side. Leave it to the private sector. The employees can decide what they care more about.
Well, Justice Scalia, before me that I can rely on is the statute that Congress enacted. Your point would cover, of course, equally the donning and doffing in Steiner itself. Congress made some choices about things that were going to be compensable. It's worth noting that Congress drew a line about whether, in terms of whether there was a collective bargaining agreement involved, because under Section 2030 of the statute, in workplaces covered by a collective bargaining agreement, you can negotiate out of at least clothes changing. But I think within the framework of the statute that we do have, I am actually quite correct, and that is right now, today, the employers have no incentive to adopt an efficient scheme for arranging donning and doffing. They can put things in different buildings if they like. The employees here are required to spend 10 or 20 minutes waiting for different clothing at different times, depending on how long the lines are. It is a workable scheme that Congress designed that said, we're going to have a workday. And the employer is in charge of deciding when the workday begins or ends, but during that workday, they're going to have to pay. I did
Mr.
want to...
Mr. Goldstein, I just wanted to have a clear answer to the questions Justice Scalia asked you. Is it so that collective bargaining could not trade off the compensation for the walking and the donning and doffing for some other benefit that the employees might prefer?
Justice Ginsburg, it is an unsettled question is the answer. I will give you the best answer I can. 2030 allows for the negotiation away of close-changing time. The question whether close-changing time includes safety equipment is a matter in dispute. The Ninth Circuit held that it didn't. This Court denied certiorari on that question. The further question, if you did negotiate away the close-changing time, whether that would negotiate away the walking and waiting time has not been confronted by a court so far as I am aware. It might be said to logically follow, but it hasn't been decided. It's not presented by this case because cert was denied, and so I haven't.
So you say it's an open
question. It is. I'm confident it's an open question.
What about what year qualifies? That is, here we have no dispute that this is protective gear, but it's not any changing that counts. So how do we know whether this is the kind of donning and doffing that's compensated and or the kind that isn't?
The line that has been drawn by the Department of Labor is where I will start. And the Department of Labor, and let me give you some citations, says that the line is between whether the employer requires you to do the donning and doffing on the plant or not. The citations for that are Section 785.24C of the regulations, 790, note 65, and then it contrasts close changing that's by your own choice in 790.7G. I think that's a sensible line that's not presented by this case. Justice Breyer, it goes to your characterization of the final sentence of footnote 49, and that is sometimes. The reason I think it's sensible to draw the line that the department has in required close changing is that the employer will only require you to do it on site if it is truly integral and indispensable to your job. Otherwise, it'll be optional or they'll let you do it.
Can I ask you about the other part of the case? I mean, I think, as I suggested, most of these things are up to the agency. They're minor things of law. So, but it seemed well established in the agency reg, as well as in Skidmore, the famous line about waiting being, are you waiting to be engaged or are you engaged to wait? So assuming that this is just putting on and off clothes that are essential, so I assume you win on that part. When they wait to put on the clothes, you would think if it's like an airport, sometimes you wait. If you're lucky, you don't. Well, under those circumstances, you wouldn't be engaged to wait. You're waiting to put on the clothes, not, you know, et cetera. So why would you win on that part?
Can I, again, make sure I have the hypothetical in terms? We are, in a sense, talking about the first wait. You show up at the first
wait. What happens? You win on the clothes. They're protective gear. That's right. The assumption. That's part of the job. Work day begins. But you have to get there, and you wait to get the clothes. On that one, why not Skidmore? Why not the reg? And if so, why don't you lose on that one?
You are in that situation. You're waiting for the very first piece of equipment in the TUM case. You show up at the cage at the beginning of the day. You are engaged to wait. The regulatory citations are 790.6B and 790.7H. There's also a case that's confronted this, which is the Metzler case, 127 F3rd 959. All those authorities make clear that if the employer tells you show up to do something, show up here to put on your clothes, and because of the way the employer has designed the system, you have to wait through no fault of your own.
But suppose sometimes you have to wait. Sometimes it's a minute. Sometimes it's nothing. Is it like an airport? Or does the employer here say you must show up 7 minutes early because there'll be a wait?
It would be the same result whether the employer puts a time on it or not. The employer says, I'll give you an example we could agree on when it's a time.
Is that what the reg says?
The reg doesn't.
Surprising, I didn't see that in the reg if it says that.
The regulation gives this example, which I think is on point, and that is if you are told to show up for when the production begins, the meat's going to come across, and the machine breaks down or they simply don't start sending the meat until 5 minutes later, the fact is that you get compensated because you're supposed to be there. The fact that they tell you be there for
where it's first in the day.
Yes.
First thing
yes.
in the day.
Yes. Unquestioned.
I thought you would say that the whole principle of, you know, are you engaged to wait or waiting to be engaged, it just contradicts the principle that was adopted in Steiner. I mean, are you employed to put on your clothes, or are you putting on your clothes to do your work? And Steiner essentially repudiates that. So, you know, let's forget about Skidmore.
Well, Justice Scalia, I think Justice Breyer is testing a very particular piece of time. He's trying to say, what is — let me take you to the text of the statute again. He's trying to figure out when the final clause of 4A talks about commencement. He wants to know when it commences. Does it commence when you get in line or when you first get the piece of clothes? It's a fair question. The other side hasn't made any argument that it doesn't include the first weight, I think because you're told that you have to don. It's part of your principal activity. Let me also say — this, I think, is a somewhat academic question when it comes to — and nothing against academics, but it's a somewhat academic question when it comes to actual workplaces, because what happens is what I described before. The employers under employers that are following our rule do set up a time clock, and they say, show up at 6:23, and that's when you can clock in. They have computerized swipe cards, and the computer won't recognize them until 6:23. And it's the time after that that will be compensable. So if the court were to say the donning and doffing process starts and ends the workday for purposes of the Portal Act, everyone will understand what the
that
court is
saying. That wasn't decided below, was it? It was just a question of walking and waiting, and they weren't specific about whether that included waiting or walking pre-donning.
That's right. The reason for that is there isn't a pre-donning wait in the Alvarez case where the plaintiffs won. And the Tum plaintiffs lost on an unrelated theory that the actual donning and doffing couldn't start the workday.
But perhaps we shouldn't reach a question that hasn't been aired and decided below.
And my formulation, which is simply the donning and doffing process, would in fact leave to the lower courts the question of precisely when donning begins and doffing ends. That's a fair point.
Mr. Goldstein, since you display such respect for the agency here, what do you do about the agency's footnote that flatly contradicts your theory of the case, and which says that the mere fact that donning and doffing may require compensation does not necessarily mean that travel between the clothes-changing place and the actual place of performance would be excluded.
Justice Scalia, my answer, I think, is that you had it right in the first half hour, and that is that phrase not necessarily can mean one of two things, i.e., we're denying that it follows a fortiori, or we're simply not deciding the question. The agency itself, which the Secretary wrote this guidance, the agency explains that it meant that we're simply not deciding it. That's actually perfectly intelligible and a correct understanding of the history. Remember, the Portal Act gets enacted, and right afterwards, the Secretary issues this guidance that then gets put in the CFR. This was their first reaction to the Act. Subsequently, after several years, these are what you're referring to is something in what are known as the Part 790 guidance. Later on, the Secretary issued what's called the Part 785 guidance. And in 785.3, it said anything that in 785 contradicts 790 controls. And 785.38 is the relevant citation. And there they say if you show up at the beginning of the day and you're given instructions, or you show up at the beginning of the day and you get a set of tools, what follows after that in terms of travel time is compensable. Can I answer two other very quick points? Justice Ginsburg, you asked about mootness. I would refer you to the deposit guarantee case, 445 U.S. 326, which talks about collateral estoppel effects. There is ongoing litigation against this defendant on this question, a case called Chavez in the district court. The citation for the proposition that it will collaterally estop them is the Restatement Second of Judgments, Section
46. I wasn't questioning that so much as it is extraordinary for this Court to take a case when the bottom line is going to be the same. And since we have the identical issues with no such preliminary question in Tum, if we decide in your favor in the Tum case, then the other case is taken care of.
It's true. You could dig the case. My only point is that it is not moot, and perhaps the variety of workplaces shown in the two cases would illustrate things for the lower courts. I suspect that may have been why the court granted cert. I also want to respond to the suggestion that this is a surprise to industry with just a couple of citations. Walking and waiting time has been held compensable since at least 1961. The Mitchell case, 286 F. 2nd, 721, the Barentine case, 750 F. 2nd, 47. There was a meatpacking plant at least 7 years ago, 127 F. 3rd, 959. And this has been the agency's enforcement position at least since the late 1980s. It is sufficiently settled that the Court of Appeals here held that IBP's failure to pay for this time was a willful violation of the statute. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Goldstein.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Portal Act excludes walking time from compensation only when it occurs outside the workday, before an employee commences or after he ceases his principal activities. And Steiner held that the term principal activities includes activities that are an integral and indispensable part of the principal activities. It follows that when donning and doffing are integral and indispensable parts of the principal activities of the employees, then walking that occurs after donning and before doffing occurs within the workday, and it is not excluded from compensation by the Portal Act. Now, the employers in these cases have argued that the term principal activities does not encompass activities that are integral and indispensable parts thereof, and that Steiner did not so hold. But at the very outset of its opinion, the Court in Steiner posed the question presented as whether changing clothes and showering are compensable as part of the employee's principal activities. And it answered that question several pages later by stating that it agreed with the conclusion of the Court of Appeals in that case that the term principal activities includes activities that are an integral and indispensable part of the principal activities, and that the activities in question in that case fit within that description. Now, that was the only textual basis on which the Court could have reached the conclusion that it did. Because if the only principal activities in that case had occurred on the production floor, then the changing of clothes at the beginning of the day and the showering at the end of the day necessarily would have been preliminary to and post-liminary to said principal activities, and thereby expressly excluded from compensation.
If I think that opinion was just flatly wrong, that Congress, when it referred to the principal activity or activities, was talking about the cutting of the meat or whatever the employer hired the person to do. He didn't hire him to put on clothes. What if I think that? Why do I have to extend what I think to be an erroneous decision beyond its narrow holding?
Justice Scalia, we are not asking for an extension of what you would regard as an erroneous holding. All we're saying is that you read the term principal activities as the Court interpreted it in Steiner. Once you do that and you plug it into the statute, the plain language of the statute takes over, because it says that walking is only excluded when it comes before the employee commences or after he ceases the principal activities. Once you plug integral and indispensable into that sentence, as Steiner requires, then you are — the plain language of the statute tells you that that time is not is compensable when it occurs after dawning and before dawn.
Why can't I say that Steiner requires that interpretation of what constitutes a principal activity only for purposes of determining what is compensable? And that when we come to examine the separate question of when the workday begins, we can apply, as far as precedent is concerned, a different interpretation of what is a principal activity.
Because the term principal activity, I believe, as you yourself pointed out, is listed in the first in A1. That's the first place it appears. Everywhere else it appears, including in A2 and in the concluding sentence, it says said principal activities. So the statute itself tells you that the term principal activities has to mean the same thing everywhere it appears. And since you have already interpreted that term in Steiner to include integral and indispensable activities, that terminology has to appear everywhere in the statute.
That just because it's a compensable activity doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't going to be a break in the workday. People have talked about the dog example, and there are others. I mean, and so all you're talking about is the determination that this is a principal activity. It seems that there's a separate second question, which is how do we tell if the spacing in time between two different principal activities, and these are two very different types of activities, is a break or part of the continuous workday?
Well, first of all, that question arises not under the Portal Act, which only applies before the principal activities begin and after they end, but under the Fair Labor Standards Act itself. And that question would be governed by the court's prior decisions on what constitutes hours worked, together with the Department of Labor's regulations that address what constitute hours worked and within the workday. And what the Department of Labor has said is generally everything within the workday is compensable except for a meal period and except for a time period where there is a break that is so substantial that the employees can effectively use that time for their own purposes. And so it says things like 5 to 20-minute breaks are not periods where the employee is not working, but they are resting for the further work. That is common in the industry, and so that would be an issue that would arise when you had a break that was much longer than that, probably at least a half hour, where you can actually effectively use that time for your own purposes and are not required essentially to stay around on the employer's premises and to wait or rest to begin your work anew.
So I take it you then agree that the answer for which you argue here follows not merely from the text of 4A, but the text of 4A plus a continuous — some variety of a continuous workday rule.
That's
correct.
You've
got to have both.
You have to have a work under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and then you have to have the exclusion from that not apply.
Yeah.
The issue here, the exclusion doesn't apply, and nobody has raised the question about whether this is hours worked under the Fair Labor Standards Act, but clearly it is under the court's decisions.
But you don't get the answer from simply the text itself.
That's correct.
Yeah. Mr. Gornstein, what about in the Tum case, the walking and waiting before the donning of the clothes?
Yes, on the waiting before the clothes, there are two series of waits, the first wait and then later waits. As to the later waits, once you decide that the donning begins the process of principal activities.
I'm talking about
the initial wait.
The initial wait. You don't think that's covered.
We do think that's covered. And under the Department of Labor's approach is to treat a required wait for an activity as an integral part of that activity. So if that activity is itself compensable as a principal activity, then the required wait for that would also be compensable.
That's the word required is what I didn't understand in that. My airline example, what's required?
What the department
required distinguishes. Required is that sometimes is a wait, sometimes is not a wait. Is that required?
Well, if the employee is simply voluntarily arriving earlier than he has
to put on his uniform. And sometimes there's a wait, sometimes there's not. Is that a required or not? And if it is, where does it say that in the regs?
It's a required wait any time in order to get to the production floor on time. The employee has to be at the donning station in a sufficient period of time to get there. And if there's a wait at that time, then he's being required to wait.
Mr. Goldstein acknowledged that that issue, the pre-donning wait, was not decided below.
I'm not sure I view the question as not having been decided below, and the court also did grant certiorari on waiting time.
But it wasn't obviously decided in the First Circuit because they ruled against the employee's position.
But they said a reasonable period of time for waiting is non-compensable. And that, at least as a general rule, is not — should
but
be
— But the question of when — what waiting are we talking about, before the principal activity or only after? That specific issue, as I understand it, was not aired below.
Well, my memory, at least of the Court of Appeals opinion, is that it was saying that the wait before the dawning was not compensable because it was a preliminary activity. But if you've read it differently, then that may be.
We have to decide the second question. I think it's actually quite difficult. I can find a lot of authority that seems to me just a random
way. The court always has discretion not to decide.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, is there a basis in this record? Will it make a difference? It's not really well briefed, I don't think. It's not thoroughly briefed.
Justice Breyer, if you do not want to decide that question, you don't have to decide it.
But I don't
have
things
the
on
court
the
granted
like
certiorari. It's an issue that can be and should be resolved, in our view. But if the court doesn't want to resolve that issue, that's fine.
Mr. Gornstein, one thing I'm curious about, with all the trouble and various interpretations of the famous footnote 49, why in all these years hasn't the Department of Labor gotten rid of it?
It should have, because even at the time it was written, that reservation was in tension or if not in conflict with the plain language of the regulations. And certainly by the time of Steiner, it was clear that this kind of time was compensable.
Thank you, Mr. Gornstein. Mr. Phillips, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I just have a couple of points I'd like to make. First, Justice Breyer, I want to start with the waiting times. I didn't actually have an opportunity to spend much time talking about that. But I think the answer that the Solicitor General's office has offered with respect to the waiting time simply illustrates the expandable nature of the workday. Their position, Justice Ginsburg, or no, Justice O'Connor specifically asked that question, you're not saying that waiting time prior to engaging in a primary activity in fact starts the workday. And the answer is absolutely it does, because they find that everything that is integral and indispensable triggers the start of the workday. So, to put it into fairly graphic terms, if you have to show up in order to put on a coat, in order to go onto the floor, in order to do your services, then the waiting time for that coat counts. If, however, you also have to put in earplugs in order to get to the place where you have to get the coat, not only do putting in the earplugs count under their theory, but if you have to wait, you have that, and that extends the workday, and all of the walking in between there. So if you're asking, is this going to become a significant liability, the answer is clearly yes. For very significant compensable acts, and indeed in this context, some of those compensable acts were found by the jury to be utterly de minimis, you are going to end up with significant waiting time, and you're going to end up with significant walking time.
Was the pre-donning waiting issue decided below?
Yes, Justice O'Connor. They specifically held that all of the waiting time is to be excluded. And they did that on the basis of 790.7G before you get to the footnote, because that's the tag to the footnote, as to what is the ordinary meaning of preliminary and post-preliminary for waiting time. And the expectation is that if you're waiting to get your check and if you're waiting to check in, the recognition is that those are completely fortuitous, just as it is here. There's nobody who's structured this arrangement so that you will end up spending time waiting. Indeed, the scheme is designed to get people in as efficiently as possible.
They decided no waiting time. They didn't decide if waiting time, which waiting time? But they said, no, it's irrelevant whether it's before or after because waiting time isn't covered. So I don't see how they specifically decided, yes, waiting time is covered, but not pre.
Well, I think, Justice Ginsburg, if they specifically decide that there is no waiting time that's covered here and the plaintiffs have sought compensation for both pre and post waiting time, then the issue is squarely posed, and they've certainly posed it in their petition. And the court granted it. So, again, obviously you're free to decline to decide issues, but it seems to me that one is posed. I want to.
Well, it seems that the court below said waiting time isn't covered, so we're not going to engage in any debate about what if waiting time is work of it, which waiting time.
Right, but that just goes to the question, I think it just poses the issue of if you have waiting time that otherwise looks to be fairly ordinary, preliminary, post-preliminary activity, it nevertheless can be converted into primary activity under their interpretation of the statute. And they clearly suggest that the answer is yes. Our suggestion is that's inconsistent with the way waiting time is handled under the regulations, and therefore the answer clearly should be no. And at a minimum, the court ought to affirm that part of the TUM decision. With respect to the holding of Steiner, I mean, it's important to put in mind, two things that Steiner focused on. It focused on Section 3.0, and it recognized that there are going to be situations where you're going to be able to bargain away clothes changing. And so now you're in a situation where in some circumstances, because you've bargained away compensation for clothes changing, walking that takes place before or after that will never be compensable. In other situations, it will be compensable. That's an absurd outcome in a situation where Congress clearly had one thing in mind that it absolutely wanted to accomplish, and that was to ensure that walking, riding, traveling to the place where you actually perform the services for which you've been hired has excluded from being mandatorily compensated. Steiner doesn't deal with 4A1. The language is as plain as it can be, are not, you know, unless specifically excluded by Section 4A1. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Case is submitted.